immediate investigation didn't turn up any evidence that Ziggy had been armed. Morelli had placed a second man in Carmen's apartment at the time of the shooting, and three of the tenants remembered seeing an unfamiliar face, but the man apparently disappeared before the police came on the scene. "And what about Carmen?" Ranger asked. No one could remember seeing Carmen. The last article was written a week after the shooting, and as of that date, Carmen still hadn't surfaced. Ranger nodded.
"You know anything else?"
"That's about it."
"The guy Morelli shot worked for Benito Ramirez. The name mean anything?"
"Ramirez is a boxer."
"More than a boxer. He's a fucking wonder. Heavyweight. The biggest thing to happen to Trenton since George shafted the Hessians. Trains in a gym on Stark Street. Ziggy used to stick to Ramirez like white on rice. Sometimes Ziggy'd do some sparring. Mostly, Ramirez kept him on as a gopher and a bodyguard."
"There any word on the street about why Morelli shot Kulesa?" Ranger gave me a slow stare.
"None. But Morelli must have had a good reason. Morelli's a cool guy. And if a cop wants to pop someone, there are ways.
Even cool cops make mistakes."
"Not like this, babe. Not Morelli."
"So what are you telling me?"
"I'm telling you to be careful."
All of a sudden, I had a sick feeling in my stomach. This wasn't just some slick adventure I was embarking onto to make a fast buck. Catching Morelli would be difficult, and turning him back into the court would feel mean. He wasn't my favorite person, but I didn't hate him enough to want to see him spend the rest of his life in prison.
"You still want to tag him?"
Ranger asked. I was silent.
"If you don't do it, someone else will," Ranger said. "That's something you gotta learn. And you got no business making judgments. You just do your job and bring the man in. Got to trust in the system."
"Do you trust in the system?"
"Beats the shit out of anarchy."
"There's a lot of money involved here. If you're so good, why didn't Vinny give Morelli to you? Why did he originally give him to Morty Byers?"
"Vinny moves in mysterious ways."
"Anything else I should know about Morelli?"
"If you want your money, you better find your man fast. Rumor has it the judicial system is the least of his problems."
"Are you telling me there's a contract out on him?" Ranger made a gun sign with his hand.
"Bang."
"You sure about this rumor?" He shrugged.
"Just repeating what I heard."
"The plot thickens," I said to Ranger.
"Like I said before, you don't care about the plot. Your job is simple. Find the man, bring him in."
"Do you think I can do it?"
"No."
If he was trying to discourage me, that was the wrong answer. "Will you help me anyway?"
"Long as you don't tell nobody. Wouldn't want to tarnish my image by looking like a good guy."
I nodded. "Okay, where do I begin?"
"First thing we need to do is get you outfitted. And while we collect your hardware, I'm going to tell you about the law."
"This isn't going to be expensive, is it?"
"My time and knowledge are coming to you free of charge because I like you, and I always wanted to be Professor Higgins. But handcuffs cost $40 a pair. You got plastic?"
I was all out of plastic. I'd hawked my few pieces of good jewelry and sold my living room sleep sofa to one of my neighbors to make my charge card payments. My major appliances had gone for the Nova. The only thing left was a small cache of emergency money which I'd steadfastly refused to touch. I'd been saving it to use on orthopedic reconstruction after the bill collectors broke my knees. Well, hell, it probably wasn't nearly enough money for new knees anyway.
"I have a few dollars set aside," I said.
I dropped my new big black leather shoulder bag on the floor by my chair and took my place at the dinner table. My mother and father and Grandma Mazur were already seated, waiting to hear how it went with Vinny.
"You're 12 minutes late," my mother said. "I was listening for sirens. You weren't in an accident, were you?"
"I was working."
"Already?"
She turned to my father. "The first day on the job and your cousin has her working overtime. You should talk to him, Frank."
"It's not like that," I told her. "My hours are flexible."
"Your father worked at the post office for 30 years and he never once came home late for dinner."
A sigh popped out before I could squelch it.
"So what's with the sigh?" my mother asked. "And the new pocketbook? When did you get the new pocketbook?"
"I got the pocketbook today. I need to carry some things around with me for this job. I had to get a bigger bag."
"What things do you need? I thought you were doing filing."
"I didn't get that job. I got another job."
"What job did you get?"
I poured ketchup on my meatloaf and barely restrained a second sigh.
"Recovery agent," I said. "I've got a job as a recovery agent."
"A recovery agent?" my mother repeated. "Frank, do you know what a recovery agent is?"
"Yeah," he said. "Bounty hunter."
My mother slapped her forehead and rolled her eyes.
"Stephanie, Stephanie, Stephanie, what are you thinking of? This is no kind of work for a nice young lady."
"It's a legitimate, respectable job," I said. "It's like being a cop or a private investigator," neither one of which I had ever considered to be especially respectable.
"But you don't know anything about this."
"It's simple," I said. "Vinny gives me an FTA, and then I find him and escort him back to the police station."
"What's an FTA?" my mother wanted to know.
"It's a person who's failed to appear."
"Maybe I could be a bounty hunter," Grandma Mazur said. "I could use to earn some spending money. I could go after those FTAs with you."
"Jesus," my father said. My mother ignored both of them.
"You should learn to make slipcovers," she said to me. "There's always a need for slipcovers."
She looked at my father.
"Frank, don't you think she should learn to make slipcovers? Isn't that a good idea?"
I felt the muscles tense along my spine and made an effort to relax.
"Buck up," I told myself. This was good practice for tomorrow morning, when I intended to visit Morelli's mother.
In the order of the Berg, Joseph Morelli's mother made my mother look like a second-rate housewife. My mother was no slouch, but by Berg standards, Mrs. Morelli was a housewife of heroic proportions. God himself couldn't get windows cleaner, wash whiter, or make better ziti than Mrs. Morelli. She never missed Mass, she sold Amway in her spare time, and she scared the bejeebers out of me with her piercing black eyes. I didn't think Mrs. Morelli was likely to snitch on her last born, but she was on my quiz list anyway. No stone unturned. Joe's father could have been bought for $5 and a six-pack, but his father was dead. I'd opted for a professional image this morning, dressing in a tailored beige linen suit, complete with pantyhose and heels and tasteful pearl earrings. I parked at the curb, climbed the porch stairs, and knocked on the Morelli front door.
"Well,"
Mama Morelli said, standing behind the screen, staring out at me with the degree of censure usually reserved for atheists and slackers.
"Look who's here on my porch, bright and early. Little Miss Bounty Hunter."
She boosted her chin up an additional inch.
"I heard all about you and your new job, and I have nothing to say to you."
"I need to find Joe, Mrs. Morelli. He missed a court appearance."
"I'm sure he had a good reason."
"Yeah,
like he's guilty as hell.
I'll tell you what. I'll leave my card, just in case. I got the maid yesterday. I rooted through the big black bag, finding handcuffs, hairspray, flashlight, hairbrush. No cards. I tipped the bag to look inside, and my gun fell out onto the green indoor-outdoor carpeting.
A gun? Mrs. Morelli said. What is this world coming to? Does your mother know you're carrying a gun? I'm going to tell her. I'm going to call and tell her right now.
She sent me a look of utter disgust and slammed the front door shut. I was 30 years old, and Mrs. Morelli was going to tell my mother on me. Only in the burg. I retrieved my gun, dumped it back into my purse, and found my cards. I stuck one of the cards between the screen and the molding. Then I drove the short distance back to my parents' house and used their phone to call my cousin Francie, who knew everything about everyone. "He's long gone," Francie had said. "He's a smart guy, and he's probably wearing a fake mustache by now. He was a cop. He has contacts. He knows how to get a new Social Security number and start over far away. Give it up," Francie had said. "You'll never find him." Intuition and desperation told me otherwise, so I called Eddie Gazzara, who was a Trenton cop and had been one of my very best friends since the day I was born. Not only was he a good friend, but he was married to my cousin, Shirley the Whiner. Why Gazzara had married Shirley was beyond my comprehension, but they'd been married for 11 years, so I suppose they had something going between them. I didn't bother with chit-chat when I got Gazzara. I went right to the heart of the matter, telling him about my job with Vinny and asking what he knew about the Morelli shooting. "I know it's nothing you want to get involved in," Gazzara said. "You want to work for Vinny? Fine. Get him to give you some other case." "Too late. I'm doing this one." "This one has a real bad odor." "Everything in New Jersey has a bad odor. It's one of the few things a person can count on." Gazzara lowered his voice. "When a cop gets charged with murder, it's serious shit. Everybody gets touchy. And this murder was especially ugly because the physical evidence was so strong against Morelli. He was apprehended at the scene with the gun still warm in his hand. He claimed Ziggy was armed, but there was no weapon found. No bullet discharged into the opposite wall or floor or ceiling. No powder residue on Ziggy's hand or shirt. The grand jury had no choice but to indict Morelli. And then, if things aren't bad enough, Morelli goes failure to appear. This is a black eye to the department and fucking embarrassing. You mention Morelli in the halls, and everybody suddenly remembers they've got something to do. Nobody's going to be happy about you sticking your nose in this. You go after Morelli, and you're going to be swinging on a broken branch high off the ground all alone. If I bring him in, I get $10,000. Buy lottery tickets. Your chances will be better. It's my understanding that Morelli went to see Carmen Sanchez, but that Sanchez wasn't there when he arrived. Not only wasn't she on the scene, but she's disappeared off the face of the earth. Still? Still. And don't think we haven't looked for her. What about the guy Morelli says was in the apartment with Ziggy, the mystery witness? Vanished. I felt my nose wrinkle in disbelief. Do you think this is odd? I think it's odder than odd. Maybe Morelli went bad. I could feel Gazzara shrug over the phone line. All I know is my cop intuition tells me something doesn't add up. You think Morelli'll join the Foreign Legion? I think he'll stick around and work to improve his odds on longevity, or die trying. I was relieved to hear my opinion reinforced. You have any suggestions? None you want to hear. Come on, Eddie, I need help. Another sigh. You're not going to find him hiding out with a relative or a friend. He's smarter than that. The only thing I can think of is to look for Carmen Sanchez and the guy Morelli said was in the apartment with Ziggy. If I was Morelli, I'd want to get those two missing persons, either to prove my innocence or to make sure they couldn't prove my guilt. I haven't a clue how you do this. We can't find them, and chances are you can't find them either. I thanked Gazzara and hung up. Looking for the witnesses sounded like a good idea. I didn't necessarily care that it was an impossible mission. What I cared about was that if I started running down leads on Carmen Sanchez, I might be following the same route as Morelli, and maybe our paths would cross again. Where to begin? Carmen's apartment building. I could talk to her neighbors. Maybe get a line on her friends and family. What else? Talk to the boxer, Benito Ramirez. If Ramirez and Ziggy were all that close, maybe Ramirez knew Carmen Sanchez. Maybe he even had some ideas about the missing witness. I took a can of soda from the refrigerator and a box of Fig Newtons from the pantry, deciding to talk to Ramirez first. Chapter 3. Stark Street started down by the river, just north of the State House, and ran in a northeasterly direction. Crammed with small inner-city businesses, bars, crack houses, and cheerless three-story row houses, the street stretched close to a mile. Most of the row houses had been converted to apartments or rooms to let. Few were air-conditioned. All were overcrowded. When it was hot, residents spilled from the row houses onto the stoops and street corners, looking for air and action. At 10:30 in the morning, the street was still relatively quiet. I missed the gym first time around, rechecked the address from the page I'd torn out of my phone book, and doubled back, driving slowly, reading off street numbers. I caught the sign, Stark Street Gym, professionally lettered in black on a door window. Not much of an advertisement, but then I suppose they didn't need much. They weren't exactly in competition with Spa Lady. It took two additional blocks before I found a parking space. I locked the Nova, hung my big black bag over my shoulder, and set out. I put the fiasco with Mrs. Morelli behind me, and felt pretty damn slick in my suit and heels, toting my bounty hunter hardware. Embarrassing as it was to admit, I was beginning to enjoy the role, thinking there was nothing like packing a pair of cuffs to put some spring into a woman's step. The gym sat in the middle of its block, over an A&K auto body. The bay doors to the auto body were open, and cat calls and kissy sounds drifted out to me when I crossed the cement apron. My New Jersey heritage weighed heavy, demanding I respond with a few demeaning comments of my own. But discretion being the better part of valor, I kept my mouth shut and hurried on by. Across the street, a shadowy figure pulled back from a filthy third-floor window, the movement catching my attention. Someone had been watching me. Not surprising. I'd roared down the street not once, but twice. My muffler had fallen off first thing this morning, and my engine noise had rumbled off the Stark Street brick storefronts. This wasn't what you'd call an undercover operation. The door to the gym opened onto a small foyer with steps leading up. The stairwell walls were institutional green, covered with spray-painted graffiti and 20 years' worth of hand smudges. The smell was bad, ripe with urine steaming on the lower steps, bonding with the musty aroma of stale male sweat and body odor. Upstairs, the warehouse-style second floor was no better. A handful of men were working the free weights. The ring was empty. No one was at the bags. I figured everybody must be out jumping rope or stealing cars. It was the last flip thought I entertained. Activity faltered when I entered, and if I'd been uncomfortable on the street, it hardly counted at all to what I felt here. I'd expected a champion to be surrounded by an aura of professionalism,
I hadn't anticipated the atmosphere to be charged with hostility and suspicion. I was clearly a street-ignorant white woman invading a black man's gym, and if the silent rebuke had been any more forceful, I'd have been hurled backward down the stairs like a victim of a poltergeist. I took a wide stance, more to keep myself from falling over in fright than to impress the boys, and hitched up my shoulder bag. "I'm looking for Benito Ramirez." A hulking mountain of muscle rose from a workout bench.
"I'm Ramirez."
He was over 6 feet tall. His voice was silky. His lips curved into a dreamy smile. The overall effect was eerie. The voice and the smile at odds to the stealthy, calculating eyes. I crossed the room and extended my hand. "Stephanie Plum."
"Benito Ramirez."
His grasp was too gentle, too lingering. More of a caress than a handshake, and unpleasantly sensual. I stared into his hooded, close-set eyes and wondered about prize fighters. Until this moment, I'd assumed boxing was a sport of skill and aggression, directed toward winning the match, not necessarily toward maiming the opponent. Ramirez looked like he'd enjoy the kill. There was something about the density of his eyes, black holes where everything gets sucked in and nothing comes out, that suggested a hiding place for evil. And the smile, a little goofy, a little sick in its sweetness, hinting of insanity. I wondered if this was a contrived image designed to spook opponents before the bell. Contrived or not, it was creepy as hell. I made an attempt to free my hand, and his grip tightened.
"So, Stephanie Plum," he said in his velvet voice, "what can I do for you?"
As a buyer for E.E. Martin, I dealt with my share of slime. I'd learned how to assert myself and still be pleasant and professional. My face and voice told Ramirez I was friendly. My words were more to the point. "You can release my hand so I can give you my card," I said. His smile stayed fixed in place, more amiable and inquisitive now than crazy. I gave him my card and watched him read it.
"Fugitive apprehension agent," he said,
obviously amused.
"That's a big title for a little girl."
I'd never thought of myself as little until I'd stood alongside Ramirez. I'm 5'7", and raw bone from the Mazur's good Hungarian peasant stock. Perfectly constructed for laboring in the paprika fields, pulling plows, and dropping babies out like birds' eggs. I ran and periodically starved to keep the fat off, but I still weighed in at 130. Not heavy, but not dainty either. "I'm looking for Joe Morelli. Have you seen him?"
Ramirez shook his head. "I don't know Joe Morelli. I only know he shot Ziggy."
He looked around at the rest of the men.
"Any of you seen that guy, Morelli?"
No one responded. "I've been told there was a witness to the shooting and that the witness has disappeared," I said. "Do you have any idea who that might be?" Again, no response. I pushed on. "How about Carmen Sanchez? Do you know Carmen? Did Ziggy ever speak of her?"
"You ask a lot of questions," Ramirez said.
We were standing close to the big old-fashioned windows in the front of the room, and for no reason other than instinct, I shifted my attention to the building across the street. Again, the shadowy figure in the same third-floor window. A man, I thought. I couldn't tell if he was black or white. Not that it mattered. Ramirez stroked my jacket sleeve.
"Would you like a Coke? We got a Coke machine here. I could buy you a soda."
"Thanks for the offer, but I have a busy morning,
and I really should be moving along. If you spot Morelli, I'd appreciate a call.
Most girls think it's a treat for the champ to buy them a soda. Not this girl, I thought. This girl thought the champ was possibly missing a few marbles, and this girl didn't like the climate of the gym.
I'd really love to stay and have a soda, I said. But I have an early lunch date.
With a box of Fig Newtons. It's not good to go rushing around. You should stay and relax a little. Your date won't mind.
I shifted my weight, trying to inch away while I enhanced the lie. Actually, it's a business luncheon with Sergeant Gazzara.
I don't believe you, Ramirez said.
His smile had turned tight, and the civility had slipped from his voice.
I think you're lying about lunch.
I felt tendrils of panic curl into my stomach, and I cautioned myself not to overreact. Ramirez was playing with me, showing off in front of his friends. Probably stung because I hadn't succumbed to his charms. Now we had to save face. I made a display of looking at my watch. Sorry you feel that way, but I'm supposed to meet Gazzara in 10 minutes. He's not going to be pleased if I'm late. I took a step backward, and Ramirez grabbed me by the scruff of my neck, his fingers digging in with enough force to make me hunch involuntarily.
You're not going anywhere, Stephanie Plum, he whispered. The champ isn't done with you yet.
The silence in the gym was oppressive. No one moved. No one voiced an objection. I looked at each of the men and received only blank stares back. No one's going to help me, I thought, feeling the first licks of real fear. I lowered my voice to match Ramirez's soft pitch. I came here as a member of the law enforcement community. I came looking for information to help me with the recovery of Joe Morelli, and I gave you no reason to misinterpret my intentions. I'm conducting myself as a professional, and I expect you to respect that. Ramirez dragged me closer.
Something you gotta understand about the champ, he said. First off, you don't tell the champ about respect. And second, you gotta know the champ always gets what he wants.
He gave me a shake.
You know what the champ wants right now? The champ wants you to be nice to him, baby. Real nice. Gotta make up for refusing him. Show him some respect.
His gaze shifted to my breasts.
Maybe show him some fear. You afraid of me, bitch?
Any woman with an IQ over 12 would be afraid of Benito Ramirez. He giggled, and all the little hairs on my arm stood straight out.
You're scared now, he said in his whispery voice. I can smell it. Pussy fear. Bet it making your pants wet. Maybe I should put my hand in your pants and find out.
I had a gun in my bag, and I'd use it if I had to, but not until all else had failed. 10 minutes of instruction hadn't made me a crack shot. That's okay, I told myself. I didn't want to kill anyone. I just wanted to back everyone up enough to get the hell out. I slid my hand over the leather bag until I felt the gun, hard and unyielding, under my palm. Reach in. Get the gun, I thought. Take aim at Ramirez and look serious. Could I pull the trigger? I honestly didn't know. I had my doubts. I hoped I wouldn't have to take it that far. Let go of my neck, I said. This is the last time I'm telling you.
Nobody tells the champ what to do, he roared,
his composure gone, his face twisted and ugly. For a split second, the door swung open, and I caught a glimpse of the inner man, a glimpse of insanity, and of hellfires burning in hatred so strong it whipped my breath away.
He grabbed the front of my shirt, and over my scream I heard the fabric tear. In times of crisis, when a person reacts on instinct, that person does whatever is most comfortable. I did what any other American woman would do in a similar circumstance. I roundhoused Ramirez square on the side of his head with my purse. Between the gun and the beeper and the other assorted paraphernalia, the bag must have weighed at least 10 pounds. Ramirez staggered sideways, and I bolted for the stairs. I didn't get 5 feet before he jerked me back by my hair and flung me across the room like a rag doll. I lost footing and went face down to the floor, my hands hitting first, skidding over unvarnished wood, my body following, the impact knocking the air from my lungs. Ramirez straddled me, his butt on my back, his hand fisting in my hair, pulling savagely. I grabbed at my bag, but I was unable to get to the gun. I heard the crack of a high-powered weapon, and the front window shattered. More shots. Someone was emptying a clip into the gym. Men were running and shouting, looking for cover. Ramirez was among them. I was moving too, crab-style across the floor, my legs not able to support me. I reached the stairs, stood, and lunged for the railing. I missed the second step, too panicked to coordinate my movements, and half slid the rest of the way down to the cracked linoleum, landing at street level. I dragged myself to my feet and staggered outside into the heat and blinding sunlight. My stockings were torn, and my knees were bleeding. I was hanging onto the door handle, laboring to breathe when a hand clamped onto my upper arm. I jumped and yelped. It was Joe Morelli. "For Christ's sake," he said, yanking me forward. "Don't just stand here. Haul ass." I wasn't sure Ramirez cared enough about me to come charging down the stairs, but it seemed prudent not to hang around and find out. So I clattered after Morelli with my chest burning from oxygen deprivation and my skirt hiked up to my crotch. Kathleen Turner would have made it look good on the big screen. I was something less than glamorous. My nose was running, and I think I was drooling. I was grunting in pain and sniveling from fear, making ugly animal sounds and inventive promises to God. We turned at the corner, cut through an alley on the next block, and ran down a narrow one-lane road carved out between backyards. The road was lined with broken-down single-car wooden garages and overflowing bashed-in garbage cans. Sirens sounded 2 blocks away. No doubt a couple of cruisers and an ambulance responding to the shooting. Hindsight told me I should have stayed close to the gym and conned the cops into helping me track down Morelli. Something to remember next time I'm almost raped and brutalized. Morelli stopped abruptly and jerked me into an empty garage. The double doors were cocked open enough to slide through, not enough for a passerby to see inside. The floor was packed dirt, and the air was close, smelling metallic. I was struck by the irony of it. Here I was, after all these years, once again in a garage with Morelli. I could see the anger in his face, hardening his eyes, pinching at the corners of his mouth. He grabbed me by the front of my suit jacket and pinned me against the crude wooden wall. The impact knocked dust from the rafters and made my teeth clack together. His voice was tight with barely controlled fury. "What the hell did you think you were doing walking into the gym like that?" He punctuated the end of the question with another body slam, rattling more filth onto the two of us. "Answer me," he ordered. The pain was all mental. I'd been stupid. And now, to add insult to injury, I was getting bullied by Morelli. It was almost as humiliating as getting rescued by him. "I was looking for you." "Well, congratulations. You found me. You also blew my cover, and I'm not happy about it." "You were the shadow in the third floor window, watching the gym from across the street." Morelli didn't say anything. In the dark garage, his eyes were dilated, solid black. I mentally cracked my knuckles. "And now I guess there's only one thing left to do. I can hardly wait to hear this." I shoved my hand into my shoulder bag, pulled out my revolver, and jabbed Morelli in the chest with it.
You're under arrest.
His eyes opened wide in astonishment.
You have a gun?
Why didn't you use it on Ramirez?
Jesus, you hit him with your pocketbook like some sissy girl. Why the hell didn't you use your damn gun?
I felt color flooding into my cheeks. What could I say? The truth was worse than embarrassing. It was counterproductive. Admitting to Morelli that I'd been more afraid of my gun than I'd been of Ramirez wasn't going to do much to further my credibility as an apprehension agent. It didn't take Morelli long to put it together. He made a disgusted sound, pushed the barrel aside, and took the gun from me.
If you aren't willing to use it, you shouldn't be carrying it.
You have a permit to carry a concealed weapon?
Yes.
And I was at least 10% convinced it was legal.
Where'd you get your permit?
Ranger got it for me.
Ranger Mañoso?
Christ, he probably made it in his cellar. He shook out the bullets and gave the gun back to me.
Find a new job and stay away from Ramirez. He's nuts. He's been charged with rape on 3 separate occasions and been acquitted each time because the victim always disappears.
I didn't know.
There's a lot you don't know.
His attitude was beginning to piss me off. I was only too well aware I had a lot to learn about apprehension. I didn't need Morelli's sarcastic superiority.
So what's your point?
Get off my case.
You want a career in law enforcement? Fine. Go for it. Just don't learn on me. I have enough problems without worrying about saving your ass.
No one asked you to save my ass. I would have saved my own ass if you hadn't interfered.
Honey, you couldn't find your ass with both hands. My palms were skinned and burned like the devil. My scalp was sore. My knees throbbed. I wanted to go back to my apartment and stand in a hot shower for 5 or 6 hours until I felt clean and strong. I wanted to get away from Morelli and regroup.
I'm going home.
Good idea, he said. Where's your car?
Stark Street and Tyler.
He flattened himself at the side of the door and took a quick look out.
It's okay.
My knees had stiffened up, and the blood had dried and caked on what was left of my pantyhose. Limping seemed like an indulgent weakness, not to be witnessed by the likes of Morelli, so I forged ahead, thinking, ouch, 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 but not saying a word. When we got to the corner, I realized he was walking me all the way to Stark.
I don't need an escort, I said. I'll be fine.
He had his hand at my elbow, steering me forward.
Don't flatter yourself. I'm not nearly so concerned about your welfare as I am about getting you the hell out of my life. I want to make sure you leave. I want to see your tailpipe fading off into the sunset.
Good luck, I thought. My tailpipe was somewhere on Route 1, along with my muffler. We reached Stark, and I faltered at the side of my car. It had been parked on the street for less than an hour, and in that time, it had been spray-painted from one end to the other. Mostly day-glow pink and green, and the predominant word on both sides was pussy. I checked the plate and looked in the back seat for the box of Fig Newtons. Yep, this was my car. One more indignity in a day filled with indignities. Did I care? Not a whole lot. I was numb. I was becoming immune to indignity. I searched through my bag for my keys, found them, and plugged them into the door. Morelli rocked back on his heels, hands in his pockets, a grin beginning to creep to his lips.
Most people are content with pinstriping and a vanity plate.
Eat dirt and die. Morelli tipped his head back and laughed out loud. His laughter was deep and rich and infectious, and if I hadn't been so distraught, I would have laughed along with him. As it was, I jerked the car door open and rammed myself behind the wheel. I turned the key in the ignition, gave the dash a good hard smack, and left him choking in a cloud of exhaust and a blast of noise that had the potential to liquefy his insides. Officially, I lived at the eastern boundary of the city of Trenton. But in actuality, my neighborhood felt more like Hamilton Township than Trenton proper. My apartment building was an ugly dark red brick cube, built before central air and thermal pane windows. 18 apartments in all, evenly distributed over 3 floors. By modern day standards, it wasn't a terrific apartment. It didn't come with a pool membership or have tennis courts attached. The elevator was unreliable. The bathroom was vintage Partridge Family, with mustard yellow amenities and French provincial trim on the vanity. The kitchen appliances were a notch below generic. The good part about the apartment was that it had been built with sturdy stuff. Sound didn't carry from apartment to apartment. The rooms were large and sunny. Ceilings were high. I lived on the second floor, and my windows overlooked the small private parking lot. The building predated the balcony boom, but I was lucky enough to have an old-fashioned black metal fire escape skirt my bedroom window. Perfect for drawing pantyhose, quarantining houseplants with aphids, and just big enough for sitting out on sultry summer nights. Most important of all, the ugly brick building wasn't part of a sprawling complex of other ugly brick buildings. It sat all by itself on a busy street of small businesses, and it bordered a neighborhood of modest frame houses. Very much like living in the burg, but better. My mother had a hard time stretching the umbilical this far, and the bakery was only one block away. I parked in the lot and slunk into the back entrance. Since Morelli wasn't around, I didn't have to be brave, so I bitched and complained and limped all the way to my apartment. I showered, did the first aid thing, and dressed in t-shirt and shorts. My knees were missing the top layer of skin and were bruised, already turning shades of magenta and midnight blue. My elbows were in pretty much the same condition. I felt like a kid who'd fallen off her bike. I could hear myself singing out, "I can do it! I can do it!" And then, next thing I know, I'm lying on the ground, looking the fool with 2 scraped knees. I flopped onto my bed, spread eagle on my back. This was my thinking position when things appeared to be futile. It had obvious advantages. I could nap while waiting for something brilliant to pop into my mind. I lay there for what seemed like a long time. Nothing brilliant had popped into my mind, and I was too agitated to sleep. I couldn't stop reliving my experience with Ramirez. I'd never before been attacked by a man. Never even come close. The afternoon's assault had been a degrading, frightening experience. And now that the dust had settled, and calmer emotions prevailed, I felt violated and vulnerable. I considered filing a report with the police, but immediately shelved it. Whining to Big Brother wasn't going to win any points for me as a rough, tough bounty hunter. I couldn't see Ranger instituting an assault charge. I'd been lucky, I told myself. I'd gotten away with superficial injuries, thanks to Morelli. The latter admission dragged a groan from me. Being rescued by Morelli had been damned embarrassing and grossly unjust. All things considered, I didn't think I was doing all that badly. I'd been on the case for less than 48 hours, and I'd found my man twice. True, I hadn't been able to bring him in, but I was in a learning process. No one expected a first-year engineering student to build the perfect bridge. I figured I deserved to be cut the same kind of slack. I doubted the gun would ever be of any use to me. I couldn't imagine myself shooting Morelli. Possibly in the foot. But what were my chances of hitting a small, moving target? Not good at all. Clearly, I needed a less lethal way of subduing my quarry. Maybe a defense spray would be more my style. Tomorrow morning, I'd go to Sonny's gun shop and add to my bag of dirty tricks. My clock radio blinked 5:50 p.m. I looked at it dully, not immediately responding to the significance of the time. Then horror ripped through me. My mother was expecting me for dinner again. I sprang out of bed and raced to the phone. The phone was dead. I hadn't paid my bill. I grabbed the car keys from the kitchen counter and hurtled out the door. Chapter 4. My mother was standing on the front porch steps when I parked at the curb. She was waving her arms and shouting. I couldn't hear her over the roar of the engine, but I could read her lips. "Shut it off," she was yelling. "Shut it off." "Sorry," I yelled back. "Broken muffler." "You've got to do something. I could hear you coming 4 blocks away. You'll give old Mrs. Siak heart palpitations." She squinted at the car. "Did you have it decorated?" "It happened on Stark Street. Vandals." I pushed her into the hallway before she could read the words. "Wow, nice knees," Grandma Mazur said, bending down to take a closer look at my ooze. "I was watching some TV show last week. Think it was Oprah. And they had a bunch of women on with knees like that. Said it was rug burn. Never figured out what that meant." "Christ," my father said from behind his paper. He didn't need to say more. We all understood his plight. "It's not rug burn," I told Grandma Mazur. "I fell on my rollerblades." I wasn't worried about the lie. I had a long history of calamitous mishaps. I glanced at the dining room table. It was set with the good lace tablecloth. Company. I counted the plates. 5. I rolled my eyes heavenward. "Ma, you didn't." "I didn't what?" The doorbell rang and my worst fears were confirmed. "It's company. It's no big deal," my mother said, going to the door. "I guess I can invite company into my own house if I want to." "It's Bernie Kuntz," I said. "I can see him through the hall window." My mother stopped, hands on hips. "So, what's wrong with Bernie Kuntz?" "To begin with, he's a man." "Okay, you had a bad experience. That don't mean you should give up. Look at your sister Valerie. She's happily married for 12 years. She has 2 beautiful girls." "That's it. I'm leaving. I'm going out the back door." "Pineapple upside down cake," my mother said. "You'll miss dessert if you leave now, and don't think I'll save some for you." My mother didn't mind playing dirty, if she thought the cause was worthy. She knew she had me locked in with the pineapple cake. A plum would suffer a lot of abuse for a good dessert. Grandma Mazur glared out at Bernie.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Bernie Kuntz."
"What do you want?"
I looked the length of the hall, and I could see Bernie shift uncomfortably on his feet.
"I've been invited for dinner," Bernie said.
Grandma Mazur still had the screen door shut.
"Helen," she yelled over her shoulder. "There's a young man at the door. He says he's invited to dinner. Why didn't someone tell me about this? Look at this old dress I'm wearing. I can't entertain a man in this dress."
I'd known Bernie since he was 5. I'd gone to grade school with Bernie. We ate lunch together in grades 1 through 3, and I would forever associate him with peanut butter and jelly on Wonder Bread. I'd lost touch with him in high school. I knew he'd gone to college, and that after college, he'd gone to work selling appliances in his father's store. He was medium height, with a medium build, that had never lost its baby fat. He was all dressed up in shiny tassel loafers, dress slacks, and sports coat. So far as I could see, he hadn't changed much since 6th grade. He looked like he still couldn't add fractions, and the little metal pull on his zipper was sticking out, creating a tiny tent with his fly. We took our seats at the table and concentrated on the business of eating. "Bernie sells appliances," my mother said, passing the red cabbage.
"He makes good money at it, too. He drives a Bonneville."
"A Bonneville? Imagine that,"
Grandma Mazur said. My father kept his head bent over his chicken. He rooted for the Mets, he wore Fruit of the Loom underwear, and he drove a Buick. His loyalties were carved in stone, and he wasn't about to be impressed by some upstart of a toaster salesman who drove a Bonneville. Bernie turned to me.
So, what are you doing now?
I fiddled with my fork. My day hadn't exactly been a success, and announcing to the world that I was a fugitive apprehension agent seemed presumptuous. I sort of work for an insurance company, I told him.
You mean like a claims adjuster?
More like collections.
She's a bounty hunter, Grandma Mazur announced. She tracks down dirty, rotten fugitives just like on television. She's got a gun and everything.
She reached behind her to the sideboard where I'd left my shoulder bag.
She's got a whole pocketbook full of paraphernalia,
Grandma Mazur said, setting my bag on her lap. She pulled out the cuffs, the beeper, and a travel pack of tampons and set them on the table.
And here's her gun, she said proudly. Isn't it a beauty?
I have to admit, it was a pretty cool gun. It had a stainless steel frame and carved wood grips. It was a Smith & Wesson 5-shot revolver, Model 60. A .38 special. Easy to use, easy to carry, Ranger had said. And it had been much more reasonable than a semi-automatic, if you can call $400 reasonable.
My God, my mother shouted. Put it away! Someone take the gun from her before she kills herself!
The cylinder was open and clearly empty of rounds. I didn't know much about guns, but I knew this one couldn't go bang without bullets.
It's empty, I said. There are no bullets in it.
Grandma Mazur had both hands wrapped around the gun with her finger on the trigger. She scrunched an eye closed and sighted on the china closet.
Kapow, she said. Kapow, kapow, kapow.
My father was busy with the sausage dressing, studiously ignoring all of us.
I don't like guns at the table, my mother said. And the dinner's getting cold. I'll have to reheat the gravy.
This gun won't do you no good if you don't have bullets in it, Grandma Mazur said to me. How are you going to catch those killers without bullets in your gun?
Bernie had been sitting open-mouthed through all of this. Killers?
She's after Joe Morelli, Grandma Mazur told him. He's a bona fide killer and a bail dodger. He plugged Ziggy Kulesa right in the head.
I knew Ziggy Kulesa, Bernie said. I sold him a big screen TV about a year ago.
We don't sell many big screens. Too expensive.
He buy anything else from you? I asked. Anything recent?
Nope.
But I'd see him sometimes across the street at Sal's butcher shop. Ziggy seemed okay. Just a regular sort of person, you know? No one had been paying attention to Grandma Mazur. She was still playing with the gun, aiming and sighting, getting used to the heft of it. I realized there was a box of ammo beside the tampons. A scary thought skittered into my mind. Grandma, you didn't load the gun, did you?
Well, of course I loaded the gun, she said. And I left the one hole empty, like I saw on television. That way you can't shoot nothing by mistake.
She cocked the gun to demonstrate the safety of her action. There was a loud bang, a flash erupted from the gun barrel, and the chicken carcass jumped on its plate.
Holy Mother of God!
My mother shrieked, leaping to her feet, knocking her chair over.
Dang, Grandma said. Guess I left the wrong hole empty.
She leaned forward to examine her handiwork.
Not bad for my first time with a gun. I shot that sucker right in the gumpy.
My father had a white-knuckle grip on his fork, and his face was cranberry red. I scurried around the table and carefully took the gun from Grandma Mazur. I shook out the bullets and shoveled all my stuff back into my shoulder bag.
Look at that broken plate, my mother said. It was part of the set. How will I ever replace it?
She moved the plate, and we all stared in silence at the neat round hole in the tablecloth and the bullet embedded in the mahogany table. Grandma Mazur was the first to speak.
"That shooting gave me an appetite," she said. "Somebody pass me the potatoes."
All in all, Bernie Kuntz had handled the evening pretty well. He hadn't wet his pants when Grandma Mazur shot off the chicken privates. He'd suffered through two helpings of my mother's dreaded Brussels sprouts casserole. And he'd been tolerably nice to me, even though it was obvious we weren't destined to hit the sheets together, and my family was nuts. His motives for geniality were clear. I was a woman lacking appliances. Romance is good for frittering away a few evening hours, but commissions will get you a vacation in Hawaii. Ours was a match made in heaven. He wanted to sell, and I wanted to buy. And I wasn't unhappy to accept his offer of a 10% discount. And, as a bonus for sitting through the evening, I'd learned something about Ziggy Kulesa. He bought his meat from Sal Boca, a man better known for making book than slicing filet. I tucked this information away for future reference. It didn't seem significant now, but who knows what would turn out to be helpful. I was at my table with a glass of iced tea in Morelli's file, and I was trying to put together a plan of action. I'd made a bowl of popcorn for Rex. The bowl was on the table by me, and Rex was in the bowl. His cheeks puffed out with popcorn, his eyes bright, his whiskers a blur of motion. "Well, Rex," I said, "what do you think? Do you think we'll be able to catch Morelli?" Someone tapped on my front door, and both Rex and I sat perfectly still with our radar humming. I wasn't expecting anyone. Most of my neighbors were seniors. No one I was especially chummy with. No one I could imagine knocking on my door at 9:30 at night. Mrs. Becker, maybe, on the third floor. Sometimes she forgot where she lived. The tapping continued, and Rex and I swiveled our heads toward the door. It was a heavy metal fire door with a security peephole, a deadbolt, and a double thick chain. When the weather was nice, I left my windows wide open all day and night, but I always kept my door locked. Hannibal and his elephants couldn't have gotten through my front door, but my windows were welcome to any idiot who could climb a fire escape. I put the splatter screen to my fry pan over the popcorn bowl so Rex couldn't climb out and went to investigate. I had my hand on the doorknob when the tapping stopped. I looked through the peephole and saw nothing but blackness. Someone had a finger on my peephole. Not a good sign. "Who's there?" I called. A whisper of laughter filtered through the door frame and I jumped back. The laughter was followed by a single word. "Stephanie." The voice was unmistakable. It was melodic and taunting. It was Ramirez.
"I've come to play with you, Stephanie," he sang. "You ready to play?"
I felt my knees go slack, felt irrational fear swell in my chest.
"Go away or I'll call the police."
"You can't call anyone, bitch. You haven't got a phone. I know because I tried your number."
My parents have never been able to understand my need to be independent. They're convinced I live a frightened, lonely life, and no amount of talking can persuade them otherwise. In truth, I'm almost never frightened. Maybe sometimes by gross, multi-footed insects. In my opinion, the only good spider is a dead spider, and women's rights aren't worth dick if they mean I can't ask a man to do my bug squashing. I don't worry about serial skinheads bashing down my door or crawling through my open window. For the most part, they prefer to work the neighborhoods closer to the train station. Muggings and carjackings are also at a minimum in my neighborhood and almost never result in death. Until this moment, My only truly worrisome times had been those infrequent occasions when I woke up in the middle of the night fearful of invasion by mystical horrors. Ghosts, boogeymen, vampires.